hi, everybody. I'm David. Maharal is probably the thinker I have spent more time with, the Jewish thinker I have spent more time with than any other, except maybe Moshe. And he is one of the most prolific and I think important thinkers. And when I say thinker, I mean like a philosopher, a creator of systems of thought. He's one of the most important Jewish philosophers, but I think that my sense is that his thought is not as well known as I it should be, but in part because he is so known for that legend. He's so known for the legend of the golem, you know, like this is the guy who created Jewish Frankenstein. Like, what more do you need to know? But he, in fact, I don't know if he ever created the golem, but he definitely created a whole corpus of machshava, of Jewish thought, book after book, usually arranged around the holidays, or at least focused on a particular holiday. And the Pachad Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, will sort of seize the Maharal as his Rebbe, and follows in sort of the same style, like following the holidays in the calendar rather than the Talmud or the Chumash. But I got to know him because my first yeshiva experiences were in the Haredi world. I went to those sort of Baal Tshuva yeshivas that still exist, but I think were all the rage in the 90s. And like there was a certain movement, there was a certain time, and I went to those Baal Tshuva yeshivas, and we heard so much Maharal. Maharal was everywhere. And then I kind of left that world eventually, and he was nowhere to be found. And I wondered why that was, and I guess I have a theory, which is that the Maharal is perfect if you're seeking an intellectually rigorous, philosophically sophisticated system of thought, but one that is not engaged, or at least directly engaged, with outside thoughts, Sfarim Chitzonim, like with the tradition of Greek philosophy in particular. Usually when we talk about Jewish philosophers, we're talking about folks like Maimonides, who is directly in dialogue with the tradition of philosophy. But the Maharal is an internal thinker, someone who's at least not explicitly, although we'll see some parallels to other systems of thought, he's not explicitly referencing philosophical traditions. Nor the scientific method. He is, in some ways, it's helpful to start thinking about him as someone who relies, using Sadia Gaon's famous categories, on revelation rather than reason as his primary source of authority. But that's actually not correct, because the Maharal sees reason as guiding his system of thought, and he sees himself as a philosophical thinker. That is, the Maharal is someone who is rational, guided by thought and the power of reason, but not empirical and not historical. Having said that, he does have a vision of history, and that's what we're going to look at today. I want to say just a little bit more about the quality of his thinking that we're going to encounter, and that is that I don't want to say that it's irrational. But or illogical. That's not true, because there is a kind of an inner logic to the Maharal's thought, but it is one that is based on, and we'll get into this more as we go, but based on essences and associations. And by that I mean the Maharal has a strong belief in the essential reality of things. That is to say, all the things in the world have a kind of an essence to them, and you can intuit that essence. You can stop and think, like, what does red really mean? What does a person really mean? What does an ox really mean? Right? What are the plants really? What is their essence? What he treats the world as a collection of signs and signals that are there to communicate messages, and that if we can really tune into those messages, we can begin to read the world. So his system relies on that intuiting of essences. And then the other word that I use is associations, which is to say that this is like this, and this is associated with this. And those associations are often created just by links in the textual sources that he looks at. But there's also an attempt to create more associations, to think about the essences of things and think, what is this essence connected to? Is there some other thing whose essence it is connected to? And the easiest way to speak that out is to say, what is the essence of Passover? What is the central meaning of Passover? And then what other things in the world express that similar essence? Is blood connected to Passover? We can think of an association there, but what is the deeper level of association? Why is blood the thing that is front and center in the plagues? Why is it that this item or this item is associated with this holiday or this event? So we're going to sort of head into that. But you can hear as I begin to talk about it that even though I said the Maharal is not engaged with the Greek philosophical tradition, when I talk about his sort of love of essences, you can hear other philosophical traditions in there. And though he never says so, one has a sense that he is influenced by Platonic thought in particular. That idea that there is an essential reality that is actually more important than the material reality. The reality of essences or ideas, that's something that we know from Plato. And in a sense, you can describe the Maharal as a Neoplatonic thinker. Maybe you know that term, the sort of revival of Plato that took place in the Renaissance period. I haven't said yet when the Maharal lived, but he lived in the 16th century. So that tracks. But I think that in a way, it's better to just hold on to Plato because you're going to recognize some of Plato's thought in the Maharal if you've encountered it before. The other kind of reference point that I want to just name at the outset is that the Maharal is influenced by other thinkers, sometimes within and sometimes perhaps outside of the system. But he also prefigures later thinkers, both in Jewish tradition, and there are, the Maharal is someone who is, who in some ways lays the groundwork for Hasidic thought, and the Hasidim are constantly referencing the Maharal, but also the Maharal's vision of history in particular, again, if you've seen it before, there is something about this that will look familiar, because the Maharal is, some say, Rav Kook famously said, we don't have any need for Hegel because the Maharal already came up with this. And by that he means that Hegel has a dialectic theory of history. And many of you will have studied this in college, but I'll just name it again, which is that there is a thesis, an antithesis, and then those two, the thesis is like some idea, and the antithesis is what's not good about that idea. So the thesis is like the dominant paradigm, what's going on at this moment in history. And the antithesis is the critique of that, okay? And this has to work itself out. There's something flawed about the thesis, something that's not complete about the thesis that the antithesis is there to critique. And so after this gets worked out, there's some new idea, some more refined idea, which becomes the synthesis. And I guess I should have written it the other way because it really goes like this. There's thesis and antithesis. And when you figure out a better version of the thesis, you get to the new thesis, which is the synthesis. But then there's a critique of that, another antithesis, and then you get to a new thesis. And then there's a critique of that, and then you get to a new thesis. And that's essentially how history moves forward. And that is a progressive vision of history, right? There's progress because we are getting clearer and clearer. We're getting more and more, we're getting closer and closer to the truth as we critique the things that propose themselves to be the truth, okay? So that sort of one thing, its opposite thing, and then some new thing that comes about through the battle of ideas, that is something that the Maharal is also articulating a version of. And sort of Maharal 101, if I was teaching to a group of non-rabbis, I would probably start with his book Netzach Yisrael, The Eternity of Israel, where he begins by saying, Hadavar hatov noda mihafcho. Every good thing is really known, truly known, through its opposite. We need opposing forces in order to understand the truth. That's a very broad way to put an idea that is really at the center of his thought, the idea that we know about truth by seeing anti-truth, and that there has to be anti-truth in the world in order to understand truth. That's how truth gets clarified. So again, sort of proto-Hegelian in that sense. But that's like Maharal 101, and because I am with a group of rabbis, I want to do kind of 102 and to take a look at a more complex selection from the Maharal, and that is the first part of this book, Ner Mitzvah. And Ner Mitzvah is a book which is, I said that most of his books kind of take their inspiration from one of the holidays, and Ner Mitzvah is a book that is devoted to Chanukah, but the whole first part, and there's like a there's a whole first section here. Before he ever gets into Hanukkah, he spends his time writing an essay on the Arba Malchiot, the four kingdoms. Okay, and that's essentially what we're going to be looking at today is the Maharal's take on the Arba Malchiot, which is a concept that you may have come across before, the Arba Malchiot, that he didn't come up with that concept, but he's going to augment and develop that concept in order to build a kind of vision of history. And the last thing I want to say before we dive in is that we're not just studying the Maharal in order to see what he thinks of history. Like Hegel had a vision of history. He's got a vision of history. Marx has a vision of history. We're also looking at this particular question because the Maharal is interested not just in history as a phenomenon, but interested in solving a particular problem in history, which is why the Jews suffer so much. And he's always grappling with this problem. Why is it that the people whose essence is the highest, noblest, holiest, most exalted, why are those people in the lowest, most debased, degraded status in this world? That doesn't make any sense to him. That doesn't compute within his system. And so he's trying to solve for that problem. Why did Jews suffer so much if the essence of Torah and Yisrael is something so good, something so holy? I've seen this stuff before, so I'm going to read the Aramaic, and maybe someone can read the English for me. We'll go kind of line by line. Let's take a look. This is from the 7th chapter of Sefer Daniel, where Daniel gives over his dream or his vision. Right? Nebuchadnezzar has a vision in the earlier part of the book, of like a tree that grows and then falls, and then Daniel has this vision. And this is really where we get the idea of the Arba Malchiot, the idea of the four kingdoms. Chazei chavet bechezvi im lelia, va'aru arba ruchei shamaya, magichan leyama rabba.
In my vision at night, I saw the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea.
Va'arba chevan, ravrevan salkan min yama, shanyan damida.
Four mighty beasts, different from each other, emerge from the sea.
Kadmaita ka'arye, v'gapin dinasharla, chaze havet ad di meritu gapa, unetilas min ara, va'al raglin ke'enash hakimat, ulevav enash yehivle.
The first was like a lion, but had eagle's wings. As I looked on, its wings were plucked off, and then it was lifted off the ground and set on its feet, like a person, and given the mind of a person.
Va'aru chevya achri tinyana dam yeledov ulistar chad hakimat utlat ilin bapuma bein shina v'chein amrin la kumi achuli basar sagi.
Then I saw a second, different beast, which was like a bear, but raised on one side, and with three fangs in its mouth among its teeth. It was told, arise, eat much meat.
Basar dana chaze havet v'aru achri kinmar v'la gapin arba di'of al gaba v'arba reshin lechevita v'shaltan yehivla.
After that, as I looked on, there was another one, like a leopard, and it had on its back four wings like those of a bird. The beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it.
Okay. Basar dana chazi hevat bechezvi leila v'aru chevya revia dechila v'eim tani v'tekifa yatira v'shinayin di farzela ravravan achla u medeka ushaara baragas v'hi mishanya min kol chevata di kadama v'karinen asarla.
After that, as I looked on in the night vision, there was a fourth beast, fearsome, dreadful, and very powerful, with great iron teeth, that devoured and crushed and stamped the remains with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts which had gone before it, and it had 10 horns.
Ah, Karnayin. Karnayin Asarla. 10 horns. Okay, can someone just explain this for us real quick? I mean, what is it? What is the meaning of this? Daniel himself gives us the meaning of it. Daniel says that these represent four kingdoms and that the fourth kingdom will be different from the rest. But that's sort of where Daniel leaves it. Sefer Daniel is, in some ways, the most mystical of the books in Tanakh, and it's confusing. So we have the vision, and we have some explanation of the vision, that there are four kingdoms, and the fourth is different from the rest. From what we see here, from what you know of Daniel, anybody want to expound on this? Why am I being given all these animals? Is there anything in this vision that is telling me something more than just that there are four kingdoms coming?
I mean, I guess the assumption is that like they'll represent the different kingdoms of this time. So like, one will be the Bavel, and one will be Ashur, and one will be Persia, and Persia's the third, and the fourth is yet to come, or maybe the fourth is Persia, and I missed one of the something like that.
Good. That's right. All right, there are debates over which kingdoms exactly Daniel meant, but presumably Bavel is one of them. Did he start with Mitzrayim? Is he referring back to all of Jewish history? Or do we start with Bavel, and most accountings do? And then what about Paras u'Madai? Are Persia and Media two different kingdoms? Yavan and Roma, are those two different kingdoms? What exactly is he talking about? But yes, presumably he's referring at least to the kingdom that he lives under, Bavel, and he lived in Galut. So that's one of them. And then he seems to be predicting more to come in the future. Okay, that much seems straightforward enough.
No, I wasn't sure for a second, but what were you asking? In my mind, going back and forth between the history presented by Daniel and the history that, for lack of a better word, the real history of Daniel. Where he's dealing with the Seleucid.
Right, exactly. And that would be one of the Seleucid kingdom would be like one of the last one, I guess. Yeah. How to map that on? I'm, what would be the four in that case?
No, I'm not sure. We talked about one kingdom would be different from the rest. I'm just thinking, because I think we know when Daniel was written, because there's a place where his description of what's going on goes off the rails. So, as I recall.
Right.
But this might not, now I'm just putting this aside.
Well, this is definitely like sort of psychic prophetic history, right? That it's not even history, really. It's funny, we don't call Daniel a prophet, but this is essentially prophecy. I mean, this is like, that's what it feels like. Yeah.
I find this so powerful as a model to think about history. I mean, I can totally understand why people for the next, 2,000 years picked on this, because everything that happens is so confusing. No idea what's happening. You're really scared.
Yeah.
The armies are after you, and here you are, and you can stick it on there, and you can go this last beast that's coming, different from all the others, 10 horns, and you're like, and that's like, this is my ruler, and that's his son, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I think it's very powerful.
Wow. To make some kind of order out of all of the chaos. And this really is a time when the world that ancient Israel knew was in now total chaos. Some idea that this could all be destroyed and Jewish history could be over. And here is some vision of, I can explain the chaos. And it's going to be chaotic for a while, but it will continue. So, yeah, there's something about that is, I'm not sure if comforting is the right word, but you can see how this would speak to certain anxieties. Yeah.
So, like rabbinically, they usually, from what I've read, use the fourth kingdom to be Rome, and then when I was at Eishet Torah, they made that leap straight to Germany in 1938
right.
and 45,
right.
And then they tried to draw as many parallels as they could, and counter to what you said, that's when I kind of got off the boat. And I was like, nope, sorry, I don't really want anything to do with this. So the challenge for me, or and potentially for the Maharal, or for anybody who plays with Daniel, is you can make it look like whatever you want it to make it look like. And if you want to scream, we're right, we can see the future, you can do that. But it's also very off-putting if you're audience doesn't see the future of doom and gloom the way you do.
Yeah, that's well said. you are raising, you're bringing us back to, I think, one of the important questions that we have to deal with here, which is, what is that fourth kingdom? And why is it different from all the others? And you're reminding us of one of the classic answers, which is that kingdom is Rome, yes, but Rome's dominion, as far as the rabbi is concerned, is still going, and as far as they can see, is going to keep going. And so Rome becomes the kingdom that lasts forever, or until the end of time, or until the redemption. That's like, we have to figure out as we head into this, why is that fourth kingdom different? That seems important. We'll deal with that. But the question, the problematics that you're raising are certainly legitimate as well. I don't think the Maharal is as troubled as you are by some of those difficulties. Yeah, Tara.
Just internal to the text, and this might be obvious, one of the ways that the fourth beast is different is that it actually has no, like, animal analog. All the other beasts mm-hmm. are
good.
Identified with, like, some combination of real, actual animal, and the fourth beast is just, it's a beast, and it has 10 horns, and it's very scary.
Good, good. That's important. All right, so let's start putting categories on the board. We said we're going to work with associations here, but Danielle's already giving us some associations, right? Beasts and kingdoms. So what are the four beasts? Let's just name them. They're hybrid beasts, but they're lion with eagle wings.
The bear, three fangs.
Yeah. Okay. Bear.
The leopard bird.
Okay, and then the leopard bird. I'm just going to call them the bear, the lion, and the... We can remember the other things they have. The lion, the bear, and the leopard. Oh, my. And then what's the fourth kingdom? We don't know. And as Mark was just saying, there's something about this description in Daniel that is so vague as to allow for any interpretation. So it sort of seems like, well, this is dangerous. The Maharal can make of it anything that he wants to. But never fear, if that was indeed your fear, because the Maharal then gives us another big chunk of text that is meant clearly as a first explanation of the four kingdoms vision. And you're already giving us some of that information. You're already familiar with the attributions that the rabbis gave to this system. But here is the Midrash that the Maharal quotes. And I'm not even going to say what he's doing. You can kind of tell what he's doing. So let's read it through first. And then we'll try to map the two texts together. And we'll be well prepared to head into the Maharal himself. So again, I'll read the Hebrew. And would you read the English for me? Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish patar karya begaluyot.
Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish interpreted the second verse of the Torah with the various exiles.
V'ha'aretz haita tohu ze galut bavel. Shenemar ra'iti et ha'aretz vehine tohu.
The earth was chaos, that is Babylonian exile. As it says, I have seen the earth, and behold, it is tohu.
V'vohu ze galut madai, v'yavhilu lahavi et haman.
And vohu, void, that is the Persian exile. As it says, they scrambled to bring Haman to the banquet.
Now, that connection is a little trickier, but yeah. Vayavhilu bohu, they scrambled, and so, okay. They found a connection, but that one's maybe not the strongest. Okay.
Vechoshech, zegalut yavan, shehechshicha einehem shel Yisrael begzerotehen, shehaita omeret lahem, kitvu al keren hashor, she'ein lechem chelek be'elohei Yisrael.
And darkness, that is the Greek exile, for they darkened the eyes of Israel with their decrees and said them, write on the horns of your cattle that you renounce the God of Israel.
Al pnei tahom, zegalut mamlechet harasha, she'ein lahem cheker, kamo atahom.
On the face of the deep, that is the exile of the wicked kingdom, whose end is unfathomable like the deep.
Okay, and who's the wicked kingdom?
Rome.
When they say the wicked kingdom, they mean Rome. And you can see here, when does Rome's dominion end? They didn't know, and they sort of terrifyingly, they looked into the future, and all they could see was Rome's dominance. Okay, and then finally, Veruach Elokim Merachefet, Zeruchu Shel Melech HaMashiach.
And the spirit of God hovered. That is the spirit of the Messianic King.
Okay, now that's an addition, but we've got now four kingdoms. Okay, why quote this right after Daniel? What is the Maharal suggesting?
I'm assuming he's laying out the understanding mostly of our various forms of exile.
Correct.
He's going to list out, and that
presumably we're living in the fourth exile, or like at the time he was writing, we are currently in the fourth exile.
Correct. So presumably, whatever the fourth beast is going to equate to Rome. And then the leopard is?
Greece.
Persia and Babylon.
Oh, I guess I was thinking maybe that the fourth that had yet to come might be more ambiguous than Rome. And the Maharal was going to place.
Well, I think that calling it the Wicked Kingdom is a way of saying that it's bigger than Rome. Yes, it's Rome, and it's them, and that they are the current harnessers of this force of dominion. But I think the ideas are there is something different about them, and they have established a kind of a new world order that is no longer about Romanness, but just about something that stretches on and on. And I often wonder if the rabbis or the Maharal would say, as Mark was saying, that, you know, then Christianity is the continuation of that kingdom, and then, I don't know, capitalism is the continuation. Like, are we still in the Roman exile?
If I remember my history correctly, you know, the time when he was living was right, you know, you had a very, very Catholic kingdom where Prague was, and this was the time shortly after the Reformation when half of Europe is engaged in these. So it makes sense that he would see the really strict Catholic regime that he was living under as
an extension of Edom, right? Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, both in the Daniel dream, and I guess by evoking creation, it happens in one fell swoop at the beginning. It's not an unfolding of history. It's sort of like those Midrashim that are like 10 things existed before anything existed.
Right.
You know, so is maybe this is part of the history question that we'll be laying out, but is this history, or is it like all done once it starts?
Okay, good. Let's deal with Jonathan's very very important question here. I think this is a very important question. What is this Midrash doing for the Maharal? I mean, one thing it's doing is giving us some associations. Like, now we can map this out. But, like, what does it mean to say that these things were there in the first moments of creation, that God, the Torah, is already hinting at the four kingdoms that will come? What do we get from that? What is that saying about this whole system? Yeah.
I mean, also, it's sacred history. I mean, I guess all history can be completely sacred, but not, it was a secular history.
Or detail.
And it's predestinated, basically.
Yeah, good. Okay, so there is something predetermined, something intended. This is like the way that it is meant to be. If it's there all the way at the start, then this is like programmed into the system. This is not just, oh, I can see the signs and the way things are playing out. But no, these, strangely, the suggestion is God is putting these kingdoms into the system. The creation itself has these forces embedded in it. And that's a sort of a startling thing to say, but that seems to be one of the implications of this Midrash, which you wouldn't necessarily get from Daniel.
Yeah, I wonder if it's creation or pre-creation. Kadma Lama.
Right.
This is even, so if I'm reading it correctly, that means Golut preceded Gula.
That's right.
And is creation Gula?
That's right.
Is there Gula started? This is where we're going.
This reminds me of the Midrash that says that God created tshuva before God created the world. Yeah. Great. All of which is to say there's something about this system, which seems to be like just an unfortunate series of calamities, that actually perhaps is there for a reason. Is like meant to address something that will go. Just like if I create tshuva before you sin, then I've got something that you can do about it. There's something about this that's there before. It's like meant to be. Sof maaseh b'machshava tchila. This was in God's consciousness even before it played out in the world. I think I'll keep doing the same thing, which is I'll read since I've seen this before, and somebody else can read the Chaim. Maybe you could read the English for me if you would. We'll go paragraph by paragraph. V'yesh li shol. כי אלו דלת מלכויות שהעמיד השם יתברך בעולמו, אין ספק שלא היו כך במקרה, רק כי כך מחייב סדר עולמו שסידר השם יתברך. ואם כן, למה היה זה שיהיו ארבע מלכיות דווקא?
And we may ask, these four kingdoms which Hashem Yitbarach established in this world, there's no doubt this state of affairs is no accident. Rather, it must be that it is necessitated by the order by which Hashem Yitbarach ordered the world. If so, why is there had to be these four kingdoms?
Okay, so that's his opening question, but in the question there are some big claims, big presumptions, and along the lines of what you were just saying, you can see that word. There is an order to the world. God ordered the world. Siderat olamo. God put the world into an order. And there's no doubt that this state of affairs is no accident. Shelo hayu kach b'mikre. Why? What is he saying there? What does he mean? This is no accident. Maybe this was a historical accident. What is the ontological kind of claim that he's making here?
You mean theological.
You're more precise with the words than I am, so you tell me.
No, because if God is, if there's no order, then that puts question on theological questions of God's existence.
Good, okay, so just a straightforward implication from the existence of God altogether. Right. If there is a God, then this world is not chaos and accident. But yes, but I think his claim is even stronger than that. I think he's saying something, you could have a God and still have accidents or happenstance, but in his vision, the world is, yeah?
It could be three, like, alternatives that he's proposing. One is, if God orders the world, there's only one kingdom, and it's God's kingdom. The alternative is, if God orders the world and God is infinite, then there are always going to be more and more and more kingdoms, therefore there are infinite kingdoms. And then the last possibility that I see is just a simple questioning of this premise, which is, if God created the world and the world has order, then four must be a magic number. Why is it four kingdoms and not five or three?
Good, good. Okay, good. The first thing you said was interesting. I want to just play with it for a second, because it seemed like, if they knew that there's something about, like, God is the Melech, Malchei HaMlachim. So God's being is one of dominion and kingship, so to speak. If there are other dominions in the world, God must have allowed them to be. God must have given over some of God's power. There's a relationship here between this phenomenon and what we believe God to be. So there must be some interaction between the two. So that's one point, which I think is, I hadn't thought of that, and I think that's a very strong read. But the other thing you said, in this world, everything has meaning and everything is part of the order. So it isn't just that God intends things to be, but if there are four, then just like we do when we read the Torah, we ask, why is this letter there? Why is this word there? Why were there four kingdoms? Why are they these kingdoms? Why are these animals used to describe these kingdoms? Everything that is in the world has kind of meaning that can be read. And so we have to ask, there's no way that God wanted us to experience some exile and put out three or four. Let's just see what happens. No way. Four is important. It means something. Yeah.
Thinking back to what Katya said about how there's something comforting about you're experiencing thing after thing, and no, even the number of horrible things you're experiencing is clear.
Yeah.
I think it's also significant. Sorry. I think it's also significant because we're at the fourth, which means the next one is right around the corner.
Yeah.
It's also anti-Aristotelian, right? There can't be some unmoved mover here. It has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. There is someone making this happen with intention.
Right.
Not just it got started and then off it goes and this is just how it's going to roll out.
Right. That's the God that can exist along with accident. God who sets the world into being, but then just who knows. No, this God is a God of will and a God of planning and a God that has thought all of this through and is directing things, right? So it is a particular theological vision. Yeah.
But even within an Aristotelian view, and similar to how Maimonides is able to explain miracles, the idea is that you set things in motion, but there are planned things that are a part of that motion because you can see the accidents that happen.
There's something about the very notion of an all-powerful God that that does away with any possibility of chaos.
It is an interesting claim because it seems very similar to like the biblical prophets in seeing God's actions through the or seeing God's work through the actions of foreign rulers and foreign kingdoms. So saying, it almost is like a weird, when you think about a weird confirmation of the divine right to rule of these various.
Right,
kingdoms.
Right.
Because the idea is that God intended for these empires to exist for some larger, you know, metaphysical reason that we may or may not.
Okay. That question of what the reason is, and I want to respond to you just as a fellow learner, because I'm not sure about this, but I think you're right that there's something about this that's very similar to the prophetic message, but it feels to me like what's different is that the prophets are saying, these things are going to happen, and you better repent, and if you do good, good things will happen, and if you do bad, bad things are going to keep happening to you, whereas the Maharal seems to be saying, it's like, this is inevitable. This
pure
is supposed
fate.
To happen. This is not just the result of your bad behavior, pure faith. What's that?
It's already
happened, yeah. So I think yes, and there's something that's like unusually distinct of this, yeah.
But it kind of goes back to my earlier wondering, which is that we need a reason to go through these four stages, right? If you're going to get to the final stage and it's just going to stay that way, why couldn't you start there?
Okay, all right, so let's keep going. He's going to give us some reasons, though they're not entirely obvious. I'm not 100% sure. There's some method here, but I haven't nailed it all down, so you'll help me. Ubiyor ze, ki ra'ui shiyu nirmazim elu dalad malchuyot bereshit habriya. Ki elu dalad malchuyot shehem moshlim ba'olam, lo hayu rak bishvil ki I efshar shiyeh ha'olam, shehu ha'alul min Hashem yitbarach, shiyeh ha'alul hazeh below chisaron, rak nimtza imo chisaron. V'chisaron hazeh hem dalad malchuyot. Lefi shehachot ha'elu, mimatim kvod Hashem yitbarach ba'olamo.
The explanation is this. It's appropriate that there would be hints of these four kingdoms at the beginning of creation, for these four empires which have dominated the world only exist because it would have been impossible for the world, which is a dependent, created entity of Hashem, to exist without a deficiency. And therefore, we find within it deficiencies. These deficiencies are the four kingdoms, for they minimize the glory of Hashem Yitbarach.
Okay.
This is the Kabbalistic.
This is wild! Yeah, well, why do you mean this is Kabbalistic?
Kabbalistic, the idea of there's brokenness in the world by virtue of God having to contract God's self out of creation, and therefore not, you know, the creation itself is not only divine, it is flawed and needs...
Kingdoms are clipped.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I think you're right. That tracks. But let's remember, this is not neglect. This is not revealed. We don't know what the Kabbalistic underpinnings are. So let's just take the words at face value. This is like, I said it was a big claim to say that there's no accidents in the world, but this is even an even bolder claim. What exactly does he mean to say the world cannot exist without deficiency? And so it's a funny thing to call these four oppressive empires deficiencies, but that's what they serve as deficiencies because it can't be otherwise. So what does that mean? Like, speak it out in non-Kabbalistic language.
Otherwise, it would be as good as God.
Yeah.
It has to be lesser than God. So.
That's right. God is perfect. God is the thing. And the world is the consequence of God, the alul, that which results from God. Only the source can be perfect. The iteration is lacking something. It's not as perfect as the source. And that has to be the case because God is perfect, and so nothing else can be. Does that make sense? Are we just playing a language game here? Or like, what does he mean by that? What does it mean to say that that all oppression in the world, it has to be there because it's a way of showing that this is not God. This world is not God because God's glory has been diminished in this world.
I think it comes back to what you sort of said at the beginning, where he's dealing with this problem of Jewish suffering in the world, right? And then we have, right, throughout the Torah, it's this idea that, like, there isn't even history before, right? All that's happening is God's will. When the prophets speak, they're saying, don't think this is history, don't think this is Bavel, but this is God punishing or rewarding based on God's needs. There's nothing outside. And then he's living in this world, you know, in the 1500s, and that hasn't seemed to happen for 2,000 years, right? And he doesn't want to give up, right? He feels like, as a Jew, giving up the idea of God's providence or God's hashgacha in the world feels like that's like too far to give, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of philosophical things. But at the same time, he wants to say, look, is there a way that God is present in history, even as history feels like it's so deeply devoid? And I think that having history be something, I think that these Arba Malchuyot represent history. And having history be something that was created on Erev Shabbat of that first week or whatever, right? Like the unicorn or the mouth of the ass or whatever, right? It's like, it's a bria b'fnei atzma. It's like, this is a thing on its own that is running and that we have to deal with in the world that isn't just God's will, but its existence was God's will.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it puts it in the sort of problem of suffering and of illness, but it sort of brings it out into something where it's like, we're dealing with this in some like deeper way. And I think he's sort of capturing like the way that we're thrown into this.
That's just exquisitely put. And I'll leave it there. The only thing the highlight is the use of providence there. That this allows for a world in which there is still divine providence. If we are suffering in exile, it's not just confusing because we're supposed to be so noble, but also, like, is God not active in history anymore? God was in Mitzrayim. Is God not anymore? And this is a way of having God continue to be active in history. Oh, no, God is active in history. God's doing this. This was a creation of God's that God intended, and now we're trying to figure it out. Yeah.
It seems to me, I mean, Luria, I just looked this up. Luria was contemporary.
That's right. That's right.
And at least I know he's an Ashkenaz, but certainly for Luria, I mean, this is all the period after the aftermath of the expulsion from Spain,
yeah.
When Jews, lots of Spanish Jews, stayed there and converted, partially because they thought. Spanish Jews are converting in 1300, but partially because they thought, well, the Christians seem, God seems to like the Christians.
Yeah.
And they think maybe they're right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think this is where Ethan was going as well, is to say that, yeah, this is like a response to a particular. Jews have suffered throughout history. This is a particular moment of crisis after the expulsion from Spain, in which it's no surprise that Kabbalah rises to say, oh, no, no, there's a brokenness in the world that needs to be, the shards of holiness have been scattered and you need to go out into the galut to gather. There are all kinds of theologies that come to address this particular rupture and to give some comfort in a moment where it seems like all hope is lost. The Maharal's approach will be different than Luria's, but I think you're right to say that they're responding to, I feel a little funny saying to like, responding to Jewish suffering because that is beyond the 1500s, but yes, there is something particularly severe in this moment in time. This next paragraph in some ways is the most important, and here we really get the Maharal. So far, he's been sort of glossing the two texts that we've seen before, but now he's going to add a new twist. Ki bavadai ma shera'a dalet malchiyot betzelem adam, ki elu dalet hemo dalet kochot shehem ba'adam. Ha'echad hu koach gufani, ha'sheni koach nafshi. V'koach ze af ki hu gamkein hu keguf shel adam, eno mutba koach begufo, kmo shehu hakoach shelifneze. Hagimel hu sichli, shehu nivdal legamre min haguf, kmo shehu inyan hasechel, shehu nivdal.
And the reason he saw these four kingdoms in the image of a person is that these four kingdoms are like the forces within a person. The first is the bodily force, goach gufani. The second is the life force, goach nafshi. This capacity, even though it is very similar to the body of a person, is not entirely within the body, as the bodily force is. The third is the intellectual force, goach sichli, which is entirely separate from the body, for all intellectual concepts are separate.
All right, so these forces in a person, we're going to have to spend some time figuring out exactly what they are. The bodily force, and you could suggest different translations than the ones that I've given. Koach gufani, that one seems pretty straightforward, the bodily force. Koach nafshi, that one's trickier, and what he means by that is, I did my best here, but I'm happy for any help that someone might want to offer.
Emotional?
Well, that's right. this triad of sort of body, mind, usually has in the middle space and emotional heart passions. And we often speak about like nefesh, ruach, and neshama in Kabbalistic systems, but the Maharal as well, as sort of the heart and the body. I think in this case, he's using nafshi a little bit different, and it works because the emotional life and the passions are those things which are meant to drive us, move us forward. But in this case, I think that he's referring to something more basic, which is like the nefesh being the basic life force or the force of movement. There's something different about the bodily forces like eating and breathing, and then the animating force of the nefesh that actually moves the body around. And this, by the way, is also a kind of Platonic structure. Plato also speaks of the of three parts of the self, one of which is like the appetite and the spirited, and then the intellectual. So, yeah.
It reminds me, I mean, I studied traditional Chinese medicine for a while years ago, and it seems that's a kind of a system than this kind of like Western philosophical system that we're trying to like piece these things into.
Yeah.
Is that the traditional Chinese understanding is do you have a unified whole that has different components within it, but that the unifier of everything exists continuously, but and is not subjected to those forces or dynamics within the unified whole.
Yeah.
But it's not described in this way. So like in Chinese medicine, you have like the five elements, which represent five different components of the physical world, but they also map onto the physical human being in both symbology and, you know, so that you have systems within the person that are represented by these different elemental things like fire or wood or metal or water, earth, but they're not of those things. And so that the system that's used to describe them understands that everything is all continuously coexistent and interdependent and interrelated one to the other without necessitating having to really separate each one of them out, trying to understand, well, what is this one thing? Because, well, that one thing doesn't exist outside of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it doesn't really make sense to the Chinese to think, well, let's look at fire, you know, the heart center. Say, well, but, and then in Chinese medicine, you say, well, the heart is not just an organ. It's not just this muscle pump. It's really the center of the mind and the spirit. It's the emperor organ for the whole system. So therefore, why would I even think of the heart as a separate? Nothing exists separate and independent.
This is so helpful. I just so appreciate this analog. This, if we don't get any further, I want to just get to the bottom of this at least. First of all, I want to just one thing I want to just name, and we'll see later, which is this idea of a unifying force that stands above all the forces. That will come up in the Maharal as well, so that's a really interesting parallel. But in general, I'm just fascinated by, I so appreciate you mentioning this, because that is a good example of another system where mapping across, from the person to the world, and on multiple like categories at once, it's important. You can feel that it's important to the Maharal, and in other mystical systems, Jewish, like, Kabbalistic systems, but also other traditions, this idea that you would see forces in the world, like earth, air, wind, and fire, and that they would track with the body, but that also they might track with four different colors and four different, not just four body parts and four different directions. And yeah, like, I am really interested in why that kind of, what does that kind of mapping do for the Maharaj? Why is that an important, why is he attempting to create those links, and why does Chinese medicine do that as well? It's a certain way of seeing the world, and I'd love to hear you or anyone else sort of expand a little bit on what we get from this sort of mapping across categories of seeing things. I mean, I'll say just the simplest version of it, which is that you begin to see everything as connected. But more, because someone give me more, because that's a question I'm really, really interested in.
I mean, the thing that resonates there, and I don't have a deep-rooted piece, it's more of like a contemporary, like existential desire, is like the appeal of something like a grand unified theory in physics, or just something that's going to take all the things that look like they don't hang together and say that they're actually all part of a greater scale. And when you can back up far enough, the things that look chaotic or the things that look extraneous or whatever, and you thought you had five, but actually these two are really just one, so it's four again. Oh, thank God. You know, like, and we don't have anything that breaks the paradigm. It's a chicken and egg question about when you're following the truth and when you're forcing the peg into the shape.
Yeah, so some of it is just like the desire, the human desire for order and elegance in system building. We've talked about the way this can provide comfort in a chaotic world, but some of it is just like the wanting to figure things out and smash everything in. Right, there's some of that. Yeah, Abe.
I wonder how much here is about seeing things in hierarchy. That the goal is to reach higher and higher and higher. That is the goal. So that's another level. The home is the lowest. And then our goal is to reach that unity, which is most high.
Yeah.
So somehow it's layered not only just at the math, but it's also layered in hierarchy.
Yeah, I think that's very, very well said, what Abe is saying. And it makes me wish I had done this the other way, because I think that's right. There's a progression here. And actually, it's like, as we said before, it's going up. It's a progressive vision of history. Even though it's disaster after disaster, what Abe is suggesting, which we'll see more of soon, is the idea that, no, but we're going somewhere, and actually maybe we're elevating as we go. And I think what I hear you saying is, the building of an orderly system also creates tiers and levels and up and down. It isn't just that you have things in categories, but that you actually develop a hierarchy. So I think that's very well said. Here's where things start to get a little bit like a little messy. Like he starts to rearrange things so that they fit into his system. It still has a beauty to it. So let's see. Lefikach, yeshiten koach nafshi. El Hamalchut Arishon. Ki Hamalchut Arishon Hayalo Hachashivut Vahamem Shalabioter. Vizehu Kneged Achelik Hanafshi Sheba Adam. Shehu Koach Moshel. Ki Ari Hu Achashuv Bachayot. Kmosha Amru. Melech Bachayot Hu Ari. Velo Hayam Vakesh Raka Hashivut Hayoter Gadol.
Therefore, the life force was given to the first kingdom, because the first kingdom was the most important and powerful of them all. And this corresponds to the nefesh component in a person, which is the dominant force. For the lion is most important of the animals. And as they say, the lion is the king of the beasts. I think he's a Wizard of Oz.
Okay, so first of all, is that a great proof for what he's saying? A lion is the king of the beasts? I'm not sure, but there is a Gemara. So that's a good source for him. But as Abe said, wait a minute. If we start here, we're supposed to start with, and we're going in a progression. We should start with the goof, the koach gufani. That's the bodily force. That's the lowest force. But no, instead he has some reason why he starts with the nefesh. And what is the reason? As he speaks it out, and this is why I didn't want to translate nefesh as the emotional force, but instead the force of life or movement. Bavel was the great empire that knocked us out of the land. Adam hu anefesh, right. The life force is in the blood is in the, or the blood is in the nefesh. So nefesh is the movement for the force that allows us to live all together. And Bavel's role was to extinguish that life, to do away with us completely, to destroy us, although Bavel didn't entirely destroy us. Before we go any further, let's take a look at the second one as well. So we start to get, this is a little out of order, so this is going to be Gufani, okay? So let's take a look first at Gufani, and then we'll see if we can make some sense of what he's doing here. V'haya malchut ha'sheni malchut madai, v'hu koach gufani ba'adam, v'chol inyan koach haguf hazeh, שהוא לעולם חסר, והוא מקבל תמיד, וכנגד זה מלכות שנייה. ולכך אמר דניאל על מלכות זה, וערו חוויה אחרי תניינה דם ילדוב.
Tani Rav Yosef, Elu Parsiim, Sheochlim Veshotin Kadov, Umesur Balin Kadov, Umegadlin Sear Kadov, Ve'ein Lahem Menucha Kadov.
This is a little like anti-Persian rhetoric here, so no offense to any Persians among us.
The second kingdom is the kingdom of Persia, which is life, the bodily force in a person. The idea of the bodily force is that it is always lacking and always taking in more. The second kingdom is like that. That is why Daniel said about this kingdom, "Then I saw a second, different beast, which was like a bear." Rabbi Sith thought, "These are the Persians who eat and drink like a bear, grow hair like a bear, and are always restless like a bear."
You know how Persians are. They're like bears. So we'll do Yavan as well. V'hamalchut she'achrav ra'a oto Daniel ka'nemer. Mipnei ki malchut zeh hu k'neged chelek ha'gimel sheba'adam, ki chelek ha'gimel hu ha'sechel. She'amalchut hazeh haya bo ha'chokhma v'ha'tfuna. Ulekach amar ki malchut shlishit mityaches el chaya shehi nemer, she'yesh la dalid k'nafayim. Ki ha'chokhma hu mitpashet b'chol tzadim, L'rochev u'le'orech, v'ein la gvul klal. Let's just read that much.
The next kingdom Daniel saw is the figure of a leopard. For this kingdom parallels the third component of a person, which is the intellect. For this is the kingdom that had wisdom and understanding. That is why the third kingdom is compared to a leopard with four wings, because wisdom spreads out to all sides and has no boundary, but continually expands.
It continually expands. Okay. And then this next piece, I think, is going to be really helpful. He sort of explains what's going on then in the Greek exile. It's not really an exile, but the Greek malchut. And here I think we get the best clue into what exactly is happening to move us from system to system, and what we might be doing it at all. Ulekach hamalchut hazot lo hayu mitnagdim liYisrael rak mitzad haTorah hasichlit umitzvot haTorah haElokit.
That is why this kingdom only opposed Israel with respect to the Torah, which is intellectual and the divine commandment.
Okay, now we have to figure out what all this means. This system, the leopard, which is the Greek kingdom, this is parallel to the Koach HaSichli. The Persian system, which is like a bear, is parallel to the Koach HaGufani, and the Babylonian system, the lion, is parallel to the Koach Nafshi. Now, what does that mean? What is he saying? What does he mean at the end when he says all Greece wanted was to attack our intellectual life? And then what mean Persia and for Babylon? What can someone begin to speak out what he sees? What does it mean to say that this is parallel to the Seichel and this is parallel to the Guf? Yeah, in the back.
Yeah, the Greeks were mostly interested in assimilation and thus giving up Torah, right? From the whole Hanukkah story, right? The Persians, right? You've got Haman, so wanted to wipe this out outright. And the Babylonians are attacking, we're attacking our very existence, our very purpose of existence.
Right, right. I think that's right, except that, as Mark was saying earlier, it's sort of like, you can interpret this any way you want. So Haman wanted to wipe us out, and that would seem to be like total extermination, which he's attributing to what Bavel wanted to do, and instead seems to be saying that the essence of the Persian exile was that it invited us to all the pleasures of the body, to eat and drink and grow, to become like these sort of embodied bodily physical creatures, where, you know, that's from the beginning of Esther, that's like the big banquet of Ahasuerus. So there's something bodily and opulent and physical about this regime and what it represents, just as, and this one's, I think, the easiest, at least for me, to intuit, because we speak about Hanukkah this way. What Greece represents is the challenge, the intellectual challenge to Jews. The idea that there's a higher philosophical system out there. There's a different way of looking at the world. There's a different kind of cultural standard. There are different values. We want you to take those values and adopt our values. You can live as long as you assimilate. Now, that kind of messaging we're very familiar with like when we come to Hanukkah. We talk about Hanukkah in this way. What the Maharal wants to do is say, that's true about the kingdom of Yavan and what we represented it. And so it is also true that the kingdom of Persia represented some kind of like essence of the body in the world. And this one's, I would like this to be somehow Bavel was the emotional, like that, if it was body, emotion, and mind, it would have sort of been made more sense to me. But instead, what he wants is to say that Bavel tried to exterminate us completely, and so what they were doing away with was our nefesh, our very life force. Yeah.
But it's like, again, it's like the way that my mind is thinking about it in the Chinese framework is that these are the different aspects of qi. Qi is like, in general, like a life force that's divided up into different categories depending on what it's activating or what it's doing. And what it seems like he's saying here is like, these are the forces that exist in the world. The fact that they have something to do with us is really more has to do with us than it has to do with them. In other words, we have to learn how to be resilient and resistant to these negative aspects by engaging with and exacerbating the positive dimensions of these four kingdoms.
Good. Okay. Now we are just beginning to get to some answer to the question, what's our role in all of this? And Chaim begins to suggest that, okay, if the purpose of these three kingdoms anyway was to attack and to attack, but sometimes even just to try to take us into their system of intellectual living or bodily living or maybe existence itself, so then our role is to maintain our, I don't know, intellectual purity, bodily purity, life itself. Somehow our role in this is to withstand the forces that would have us leave our intellectual lives or indulge in the pleasures of the body that other cultures are... In other words, they're hitting us from different sides, but our job is always the same, which is to resist this force that would seek to attack one part of who we are as human beings, one fundamental part of who we are.
It's like a pedagogy. It's teaching us. Like, these different kingdoms are supposed to teach us how to protect ourselves in various ways.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Well, it's like the same way in a mute, like when you get a flu vaccine, it's teaching your immune system to attack particular.
Yeah. It's like in
pathogens.
Again, it's like if you go to a Western doctor, so then you have that model. You say, oh, you have a pathogen, you have to get a vaccine to eliminate the pathogen. In the Chinese model, it's more like a garden. So you say, oh, you have these different components of the garden. The doctor or the health practitioner is the gardener, not the eradicator of one of these elements. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what I would think that his path is to say, that the Jew for humanity, for the world, for God, is to be the sublime kind of like, well, gardener or something, the one who holds all of these different capacities of relating to the one source.
Okay. Let's hold on that, because we'll land, we have 5 minutes, but we'll land at some kind of culmination where maybe the Jew has kind of realized all these forces. But before then, I'm really intrigued by Ross's framing that this is a kind of there's a pedagogy in here, and that we are, but initially we said that the reason for these forces in the world was just so there would be deficiency, because the world is imperfect, God is perfect, there has to be some imperfection in the world. But now it seems, or at least Ross is suggesting, and I like the suggestion, that it's like we're meant to go through these four stages, to be tried in all of these ways. Okay, there's physical battles we have to fight for our life, but then we have to learn to fight the battle of our bodies, to know what to do and how to be with the bodily part of ourselves. And then we have to learn how to grapple with our intellectual lives. The Greek kingdom is there in some sense to teach us a lesson or to provide us with an alternative that must be rejected. We have to work through that intellectual challenge and to best it or to maintain in order to advance to the next stage. So there's something very intriguing about that I would move through all of the parts of myself, and then once I had established the foundations of my being, then I establish the health of the body itself, and establish the clear working mind, and then we'll see what's next. But that's an interesting way to think about this progression. And this, I want to make sure to read this because this reminds me of what you were saying about earlier about the unifying force. Then Daniel saw a fourth beast, which was different from all the others. And that, given what we've been saying, is because it parallels the whole person, who is made up of all these three forces, the bodily force, the life force, or the spirited emotional force, and the intellectual force. These forces are not really divided in a person as if they had three selves, but are actually joined together in a unifying force, aval yesh ba'adam koach mishutaf, made up of all these three other forces combined together. So that's really interesting. And that is why the fourth beast Daniel saw was different from all the others, because this beast had all three forces combined in it. The fourth kingdom therefore seeks total destruction. That is why Daniel said he saw a beast with iron teeth, because iron can destroy and cut through everything. And that is why they burned down the house of our God, which was the ultimate form of destruction. Now, I think there's something a little funny about how Babel is like the ultimate, but also Rome is the ultimate. Like, again, sort of playing with a little bit at the ends. But it's fascinating, given where we've just arrived, right? What we've been saying about the need to move through not just these periods of history, but sort of these components of our being as we work through these phases of history. What is the last phase? What is the wicked kingdom represent where all of the forces are together? We've managed to maintain through all of these first three kingdoms. And now we're still in Rome dealing with what? What's this last battle that combines all the parts of ourselves?
The thought that I was thinking about is not so much about Haman, but about the fact that the Jews were completely assimilated into the culture of Persia, participating in the beauty pageant, participating in the government. They were completely assimilated in until Haman decided something differently, which then I think goes to this fourth, to Rome, which is Rome wants to destroy us physically.
Yeah.
Rome wants us to assimilate physically, wants us to be just completely part of Rome.
Yeah.
And the last is Rome wants to take over our intellect and do what all the other three couldn't do by themselves, but together they could do it.
Yeah, that's interesting what you're saying. I mean, assimilation is a word that we are very quick to use with the Hanukkah story, but maybe it's a word we could use for any of these phases in history. That we will be, the worry is that we will be absorbed into whatever distorted version of the intellect, the body, or the life itself. And these kingdoms, these great kingdoms, what's better than Rome? Rome represents the ultimate form of human flourishing. It provides an alternative. And our job is to not get sucked away into that alternative. And we have to hold on. Persia offered the most enjoyable bodily experience possible. It was a land of delights. But we had to figure out why that was, there was something perilous about that and why that actually would lead to our, like, we have to somehow resist all of these forces.
I just have a question. At the very end, it seems to be there's a very strong eschatological element, you know, when he says,
Okay, good. Okay, so this gives us a chance to read the last piece here, which is, and then I'll let you finish. I just want to, so we know what she's talking about. There's a last piece here that's really tantalizing that we're just going to leave as a hanging question. But the fourth kingdom thus creates a total void. But a total void brings about a new form of being, as we know. I'm not sure how we know that. Therefore, this total void will eventually bring the restoration of being to Israel. So you were saying?
Oh, I just wanted to know if you could give us a 30-second capsule.
Well, I think that takes us back to the thesis, synthesis, and antithesis model there, where there's something, this needs to happen, and once it's actually been overcome and sort of wiped out, then there's finally room for Melech HaMashiach to step in. There is like, these forces have been worked through, and finally, there's the possibility of the final kingdom, which is a kingdom of redemption and realization. Having said that, I don't think it's a great answer. I'm not sure exactly why it is inevitable, except for, you know, what we know about a vacuum. Why is it inevitably the case that a void creates the room for the next thing to come? Yeah, please.
Yeah, so part of it, the Hegelian cutting back to, so he didn't get specific, but if the Babel challenge, is that responded to by, like, the Bavli, You know, like, is the Persian challenge somehow responded to by the relationship with to get back to the land? Is the Greece challenge surviving the intellectual challenge?
I think that the answer to your question is something like the world keeps changing and sort of convulsing over and over again. But our job is to hold firm in the midst of all the changes. Our job is, that's why it's Netzach Yisrael. We endure. So our job is to maintain some kind of eternal truth, which is, after all, what God represents, is something unchanging, even as the world, the lacking, deficient world, continues to show all of its lacks and continues to sort of overturn and change. If we can maintain and hold some kind of truth through it all, then finally, when everything is cleared away, that's what will be remaining, is, you know, Shar Yeshuv, the remnant of Israel, which is finally ready to take its place now that this deficient world has sort of, like, used itself up.
Yeah.